Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. Today, we're talking about something almost everyone in this country thinks about at some point or another, and that is buying property. Specifically, what you need to check before you pay a single dirham. Because in our practice, we see the same painful pattern again and again. A buyer pays hundreds of thousands of dirhams to a developer and only afterward discovers either the project was not properly registered or that the money went to the wrong accounts or that the paperwork did not quite match the reality. By then, getting the money back is a fight and therefore expense. So today I want to give you sort of the buyer's guide, the checks that protect you, the law that breaks each one, and what to do if something has already gone wrong. Now, first, let's understand the buying property in Dubai. And by the way, I want to emphasize that today's podcast is about buying property in Dubai versus other Emirates. Now, those who've been in the UAE long enough or who are interested in buying in the UAE, I guess, would be suited to be reminded that the UAE has seven different emirates, and each emirate has its own real estate laws. Now, there's still a kind of fundamental law that that serves as a base, as a foundation to this, these specific real estate laws in each emirate, but ultimately in terms of what makes a specific project legal in each emirate is subject to that emirate's specific laws. But today's discussion, just in the interest of keeping it kind of focused, we are mainly going to focus on Dubai. That being said, you know, a lot of the principles will also apply to other emirates. And generally speaking, it's kind of a good checklist of anyone, investors, buyers, who are maybe interested in looking around and investing in the UAE would perhaps benefit from, because while the specific laws in terms of registration and specific nuances of what it takes to register a project, buy and register a project in one emirate versus the other is somewhat different, but the fundamental principles in particular of protecting investors' interests are similar. But today's discussion, as I said, is going to be about Dubai I will focus on specific laws that relate to Dubai that are incredibly essential for buyers and investors to know. But at the same time, there is a federal law that applies to all purchases, all real estate purchases, purchases across the UAE and across all the Emirates. So at the federal law, we're talking about, so there's two sets of laws. So as I said, Emirate specific, and then there's the federal law that applies to the entire country. And so that law that applies to all of the Emirates and sort of serves as a foundation, kind of a legal framework, that's the civil transactions law. And that basically sets the rules for contracts, your consent, misrepresentation, remedies, termination of contract, and so on and so forth. In fact, I have a dedicated podcast on just the civil transactions law in particular. And it kind of delves into more specific aspects of contracts and the interpretation of contracts and termination of contracts, as well as property defects and such. But today's topic is more about sort of a checklist. If you're an investor or buyer, what are some of the things that I need to keep in mind as I go through the process? So the civil transactions law is at play here, and that's in particular the law that's, by the way, it's a new law, and it's the last law that was fundamentally reformed since the UAE began its legislative reformation reform, and very, very consistently thoroughly been sort of updating all of its laws. This is the last law, the civil transactions law, that was updated and was updated in 2025. And the name of the law is the Federal Decree Number 25 of 2025. But it came into effect. In other words, it took force only in June 2026. So even though the law was introduced last year in 25. So we've had it kind of in text and had some time to read and process it. Now, in terms of its legal effect, it kicks in June 2026. And it basically governs purchases made from that date on, although it remains to be seen how the courts, if there's any disputes related, for example, to real estate contracts, that were signed before the law came into effect. And, you know, once these disputes are brought to the courts, it remains to be seen how the courts will interpret those contracts. Since this law obviously comes into effect after those contracts were signed, but to be honest with you, the old law, which is the Civil Code from 1985, and the new civil transactions law, they're not fundamentally different in some of the sort of the main and material concepts and principles that apply to particular real estate transactions. So all the source of law may differ as the courts go through the process. I think the final conclusion and the judgments will not be affected based on what source of law the court decides to apply. So that's from sort of in terms of legislative framework. As we said, we're talking about the civil transactions law, and we'll touch upon it as we go through the process. That particular law applies to all of the UAE, and today's podcast will be specifically focused on Dubai real estate. And by the way, as long as I'm on that topic, there's this from the legal standpoint, it's also helpful to set a framework as to how laws work. So you have a general law, which is the civil transactions law that applies to all of the Emirates and sort of creates like the baseline, the foundation, and sort of governs kind of a lot of general principles about contract obligations. On top of that, there is different specific laws that are introduced to address specific areas of, you know, society, of business, of trade. So for example, specific consumer protection law, specific bankruptcy law, specific employment law. So all those laws kind of are layered onto the main civil transactions law. And in the event there is, for example, discrepancy or such, the specific law will prevail. So in this case, with regards to properties, so you have the civil transactions law, which is the foundation. But if there's a specific Dubai real estate law that addresses additional elements or elements perhaps that's somewhat different from the civil transactions law, usually the specific law takes precedent. So, and just because, let's say, the civil transactions law does not address a certain issue, that's not a legal argument, for example, to challenge a Dubai-specific law, because in general, in legal terms, whenever you have a specific law, that specific law will always take precedence over the general law. So the general law, the civil transactions law, is there to basically cover the gaps on the one hand, but on the other hand, with regards to contracts, and it's sort of the baseline, it's the foundation, the backbone of everything to do with definition of contract, your real estate contract, sales and purchase agreement, booking forms and such. These are all types of contracts. And then interpretation of contracts, signing of contracts, and then termination of contracts, and then penalties and breaches and damages and such. So that's where, in terms of what remedies can be sought in the event there is a real estate breach, it's not going to be the specific laws, the Dubai laws, but rather this civil transactions law, as I mentioned. And that law is the same for all real estate investments across all of the UAE. So now that's the civil transactions law. And it basically, in sort of relevant terms, it defines and applies to definition of contract. On the other side, you have the kind of on top of this law, you have since the Dubai-specific real estate laws. And there's a whole series of Dubai-specific real estate laws. And by the way, those who are interested, they can look in the Dubai Land Department, which is the governing sort of authority in Dubai that deals with all real estate transactions. All the laws are fairly conveniently located and accessible on the Dubai Land Department's website. So there's many of them. The idea is that, so again, you have the civil transactions law, and on top of that is many, 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 many different Dubai-specific real estate laws. By the way, most of which have been around for quite some time. So the civil transactions law is the newest law. Most of the Dubai-specific real estate laws have not been updated in quite some time. So, you know, it may be that we will see some sort of legislative reform on the Dubai front. But for the time being, so we have the civil transactions law, and then on top of that, many different types of Dubai real estate laws, that all of which ultimately come into effect in the discussion that we're going to have today. So, for example, these Dubai-specific laws, they regulate, you know, developers, your projects, off-plan sales, escrow accounts, what constitutes a freehold versus leasehold, the real estate sort of foundation in Dubai. What's important to remember, what's the purpose of these laws? At the high level, the laws exist to protect the buyers, because to protect the market. Because if the buyers are not protected, if the buyers feel that their rights are not protected, then there will not be much confidence in the market itself. And so therefore, at a high level, and this is not to say that the laws are drafted in favor of one over the other, but it's generally speaking, is there to protect the weaker party. So that's kind of the function of the law of laws. So that's basically what we'll talk about today. Now, one carve out from today's podcast is that as we're talking about, first of all, Dubai real estate, second of all, mostly kind of off-plan properties, because that's where the laws in particular come into play. And this is sort of the guidelines or the checklist for buyers to in Dubai. There's certain parts of Dubai that are excluded from this law, and that in particular is an area called the Dubai International Financial Center, or DIFC, which has its own body of laws, it has its own courts, and subject to different jurisdictions. So as we're going through the process, it's important to remember that these laws, for the most part, do not apply to the properties and kind of real estate that is based in the DIFC. As I mentioned earlier, and the benefit of today's podcast, I'd hope, is to help buyers or investors to make mistakes in investing in Dubai real estate. And usually the risk of mistakes, or the risks are greater when we're talking about off-plan property. Now, what's off-plan property? It's a property that does not exist yet. So it's sort of basically it's property that's based on back of a contract, or sort of in most cases it's a sort of paper exercise. I mean, it starts with that. Some off-plan properties have literally nothing else but a contract. Others are able at least see some sort of grassroots of the building coming up, and other off-plan properties could be at 80% completed. So there's different degrees of plan properties, but generally speaking, the risks of perhaps misrepresentations or mismanagement of expectations, or potential sort of kind of risks for buyers in particular in terms of handover and expectation of what they ultimately receive in their hands, are greater with off-plan properties. And that's because, I mean, by very, very sort of definition, off-plan property, it's not something that you can actually see in most cases, or it depends on where the off-plan project, the status of the off-plan project, but in many cases, it's not something you can see, can touch, and it hasn't really been tested yet, because if it's at the very grassroots, at the very beginning of the off-plan project, there's nothing even to see other than the piece of paper or a bunch of papers that give you the best sort of visuals and pictures and image of what this sort of heavenly project would look like. That's basically all you have to go by. In other cases, may look at the sort of, you could see where the building is going to be. It's maybe a few stories up, but many more to go. So you can't really quite see your unit specifically, right? So it's so you can only expect for that unit to be what that piece of paper or the papers state it's going to be, how it's going to look, and when it's going to be ready. And then in most other cases, even when the project is, like, say, 90-95% complete, in many cases, it's not really ready for inspection. So once again, you're buying a property, or you're signing contracts, and you're putting down money on something that you cannot quite yet touch and feel. So that's why off-plan properties and off-plan investments usually are riskier, right? So, and that's because you don't know what you're buying. And now let's take all that, compare it to a unit or a property which is ready. Then you can physically go see the property, you can touch, you can feel it, you can hire inspectors and surveyors, and you can go in and have it all sort of checked inside out. You can get assessments, you can read online about sort of what, you know, what's known about that specific project or a specific unit. So there's a lot more information you can obtain, and you have ultimately the title deed for that property that shows exactly who owns it, and so you know exactly what you're buying, and you know, and you can safely estimate when that property will transfer hands and it will now be your property. So with off plan, this is so that's why it's a much riskier investment from the perspective of investors. And that's why we're talking about this today. And that's, you know, because you know, how do we help investors? What should investors keep in mind when they decide to either invest in Dubai or decide to invest in another project in Dubai or decide to invest in an off-plan project versus the ready projects which they may already be investors in? So that's sort of what our discussion today is going to be all about. So here's the first and the most important check, and this is all regulated. So what we're going to be going through next is what's regulated by the Dubai Land Department, or it's otherwise known as DLD, and kind of its offshoot is the Real Estate Regulatory Agency, or RERA. Again, these laws are all available, readily available on the website. Those who may want to educate themselves a little more, there's certainly the whole menu of laws is there and easily accessible. The starting point for Dubai investment, a Dubai project, is that before any developer is allowed to sell, and by sell, I mean any kind of disposition of interest. So how do you define disposition of interest? So it's disposition of real estate interest. So first of all, it has to relate to in real estate. A second, what is a disposition of real estate interest? It's basically anything that ultimately, in one way or another, partially or wholly, transfers interest in real estate. Well, that means, in simple terms, even the reservation form or a booking form, even if it's just, as long as it refers to a specific project or a specific unit, that's basically, in simple terms, is deemed to be disposition of real estate. So now for that, and this is, kind of generalizing here, but for anything that has to do with disposition of real estate, the key is that the developer has to be registered. So it cannot be that, for example, Ludmila decides, I'm going to imagine this great project I'm going to launch and sell, and I hire great sort of graphic designers and I draft great contracts, and then I start going, you hire marketing firms and agencies and start advertising this project and start collecting money. Now, that's a disposition of real estate, although that real estate does not exist. So for me to be able to do it, as an entity, I have to be registered as a developer with the Dubai Land Department. So that's the starting point. You have to register. The entity has to be registered. It cannot be, so me, Ludmila, thinking, okay, if I can collect X number of investors and Y number or Y amount of money, then I will go and use that money and go register myself as a developer. And kind of roll over the roll of the project that way. It used to be like that, by the way, but it isn't so. And this is, in fact, why these laws are in place. And just sort of as an interesting, perhaps less so factoid from my own life, like I came to Dubai and I saw Dubai's real estate market before these laws were introduced. So these were actual real problems. The example I gave you of me, figuratively speaking, launching a project, those were real cases. And so a lot of people did exactly that without being registered as a legal entity with the Dubai Land Department, and then launching out and rolling off all these projects, rolling out of this project to the market, collecting money, and ultimately not being able to back those deals up. So this is why these laws were introduced. So I literally saw this legal evolution before my eyes. So the starting point is it cannot just be somebody who wants to be a developer and already collecting money. And by the way, we've seen quite a bit of this recently with a lot of you know, foreign money coming in, some foreign investors of certain countries coming in and say, okay, I've got some, I know I can build this great project with the money that's coming from my country, where it is I'm coming. I can attract all these investors. Let me go grab all these investors, collect money from them, and then apply to become a developer. That is not legal. So because, again, we're going back to the starting point, which is a disposition of real estate. A disposition of real estate requires a whole sort of set of elements, one of which is you have to already be registered as a legal entity, as a developer. So not just a company, but a company that is licensed to be a developer in Dubai, right? So that's number one. Number two, you have to also then register the project itself with the land department before you launch it. So that's a project. What's a project? A project is basically, so now I'm a developer, so I have a license, and I've picked a place where I'm going to launch an off-land project, and I've got great ideas, great plans for it. But until that specific project is registered officially with the land department, meaning that the land department has approved all the specs, the timing, and when the project, the registration of the project includes, among other things, not just, okay, that's where it's going to be, but the whole sort of legal framework that will support that project. And that includes the specs of the project, the timeline, the construction milestones, and even the contracts, right? So the contracts that will kind of underpin the disposition of real estate interest to individual investors. So that's basically, so in addition to being the developer that's registered, you also have to have, the project has to be registered. And that's all set out in, among other things, in law number 13 of 2008. And believe it or not, yes, that's when I remember when the law was introduced. I was here then already. And that's the law that sets out what's called the interim real property register. So that's a register, and in particular articles 4 and 10, but that's basically a register that is there to keep record of all these dispositions of real estate, as we call them, that are not yet real projects, right? They're sort of all still in some form, written form. And that's because, the title deed, in other words, for this project cannot yet be issued because the project has not been completed. And when I'm saying completed, it needs to be 100% completed and handed over to the land and signed off with a completion certificate and handed over to, in the records of the land department, approved for complete. So in other words, title deed. So the land department has its own registry of all the title deeds, but that's title deeds apply for ready properties. But for properties that are still, before they're completed, before the government signs off that, yes, each one of these projects is now ready to basically be handed over, that's all called sort of interim register. So that was the law that was introduced in 2008 called the Real Property Register. That is basically to ultimately set up a database to register interim sales, right? So basically to register off-plan projects. So let's say, and as per this law, specific Article 4 prohibits, for example, a developer from disposing, as I said, of units off-plan before obtaining the required approvals. And the approvals, as I said before, it's approvals as a developer and approvals for the project. So there's a specific provision that says, as a developer, you cannot do this. You cannot sell anything off plan until you have all the approvals in place. Now, furthermore, the Article 10 of the same law makes the consequences of, if you do that as a developer, so it sets out the consequences of what sort of remedies are. And the consequences are pretty clear, that any contract, and this is quite important, so any contract that is entered before those approvals is considered to be null and void. Now, this is not just a simple sort of legal phrase, null and void. Null and void is actually quite a fundamental legal concept. Basically, it means like the contract is no more, like it never, not no more, it never existed. And so so in other words, the contract was, so the foundation upon which the contract was drafted was flawed, legally flawed from the beginning, and therefore anything that to do with this contract basically kind of goes away. Now, when the contract goes away, what happens? Basically, the parties, in simple terms, parties have to be reinstated in their pre-contract positions. In other words, let's say if If you're an investor and I'm a developer who sold you this interest without having all my approvals in place, and you pay me $1 million, and then now you find out that I didn't have all the approvals in place. So that transaction between you and me is considered null and void, which basically means I have to return to you your entire amount of money that you gave me, $1 million, without any kind of offsets. And if anything, there could even be an argument for me to compensate you for anything else that you would have potentially spent as a result of this kind of defective transaction, if you will. So that's this is very important. So anytime a developer sells your project, a developer, and I use developer a little loosely because I said a developer can be a registered legal entity as a developer. It could also be somebody aspiring to be a developer. In any one of these cases, under either scenario, if the sale happens, the sale, I mean the disposition of interest, the transfer of real estate interest happens before these approvals take place, the whole transaction goes away and basically the developer or the aspiring developer has to refund the full amount of money right away. And that's, you know, like specific examples, if you will, because in Dubai we have these kind of series, when we're talking about off-plan projects, there's a series of documents that usually kind of come into play for off-plan development. So it starts with a booking form, and then at some point, or reservation form, and then at some point there's sometimes like marketing materials, there could be some, you know, receipts of payments and invoices, and then there is the sales and purchase agreement. So a lot of people, ironically enough, people think, oh, the booking form is not an agreement because it's a booking form. It is an agreement by definition, and this is where the SILA transaction law comes into play. Remember, we talked about it early on. That's the definition of contracts. And so a booking form is just a contract. It doesn't matter what it's called. It can even say, I am not a contract. That does not make it not a contract. Because if it has all the other elements of a contract, which is a meeting of the mind and offering acceptance and about specific purpose and lawful purpose, something that sort of that exists, that contract is the contract. And I talk more about specific sort of definition of contracts in this civil transaction podcast. If you are interested, you may want to listen to it as well, although I warn you, it's quite long. So basically in these cases, this booking form becomes booking form or SBA, whatever it is that sort of the document you have at that point in time. If the investor finds out that in fact they were sold this interest in real estate prior to the developer receiving the proper approvals, then that, you know, the basically that whole transaction is void and null, and therefore the investor has full right to request the full refund of the investment. So as an investor, before you pay, if you are serious about being a serious investor and committed investor in the Dubai market, then you should always verify the project registration status in the DLD records. Now, on that point, as I mentioned earlier, DLD, as a Dubai Land Department, it has a fairly sophisticated and continuously evolving website that's quite comprehensive of in different shapes and forms, and it's and among other things, it has project status for each project. So, if you know, you can actually go and look up on the DLD website to see that specific project is already registered with the land department when it was registered, and all the other specific details of the project. So, it's not like you're being asked to chase a wild goose or a rainbow trying to find details. That information is available to you. So, if you are committed, or if you are diligent, or you know, if you trust the developer, the real estate agent that you deal with, if you just want to verify, that information is certainly available on the Dubai Land website, and there's no sort of more accurate information than what appears on that site. Okay, so that's basis number one, is confirm whether the developer and the projects have been approved. Now, second is, and yeah, there's different nuances, right? And it's not necessarily in a specific order, but just in the interest of picking some kind of order, we'll kind of go keep going this way. So first developer, then the project. Third is, where is your money actually going? Where are you paying the money? Where is the, what's the developer asking you to do? So high level, and this is sort of the headline of this specific point, is that for every offline project, the law requires a dedicated escrow account. So, you know, believe it or not, and that's law number 8 of 2007 on escrow accounts, and that's for real estate developments, in particular articles 6 and 9. And believe it or not, I remember when that law came into effect as well. And sort of the kind of the uproar that it caused when it did, but it came for very many good reasons. So the gist of it is that the account is open in the name of the project and is used exclusively for that project's construction. So what that means is that a developer, for example, let's say I'm a developer and I have 5 different projects. In the past, yeah, I could just have one corporate account and I would just collect money from the investors from different projects and kind of commingle them into one my corporate account, and it's under my control. So that whole practice was made no more in 2007 when the law was introduced. The law required for every developer, for every project, to have a dedicated escrow account for that specific project. So going back to my example of me with 5 different projects, I had all of a sudden I had to have a separate separate escrow account for each project. Furthermore, it wasn't just me opening up with my different banks or even the same bank, separate bank accounts and calling them, you know, sort of belonging to different projects. No, the specific escrow account is actually sort of in collaboration and under the supervision of both the developer and the land department, ARERA. And in particular, so, and it's being managed by the land department to ensure that the money is spent properly. So there's the whole, you know, as part of the project launch, when we talked about, remember we talked about the project approvals itself, and then all the sales and purchase agreement, all the sort of underlying contractual documents, as part of it also is supposed to be the escrow arrangement with the land department that's set out for the specific project in terms of how the approvals of funds are going to be managed and released as construction is ongoing. And that's obviously because sort of some projects that are 2 stories, some projects are 50 stories. And so this is where the government, the Dubai government, takes it on itself to collaborate with the developer and ensure that based on the plans that have been submitted as part of project approval and the timelines and the completion and the construction milestones, that the payments are basically the money that's being coming into the account is being spent as per the plan that had been set up and approved by the land department at the outset. So it's not just a bank account. These escrow accounts, they in fact not for the developer to just tap in or grab into and use the funds. It's always under the supervision of the land department. I remember when this was introduced, and exactly for that reason, because there's so much of commingling of funds before. So in the past, you would take the money from the 5 different projects and put it into one, especially when the financial crisis happened, all of a sudden this investors in the other 4 projects were left with nothing, because most of the money from these 4 projects might have been invested in that one project. I'm just using that as an example. So this is exactly why this escrow law was introduced. And the gist is that all the money must go into that project escrow account, and it must not go to the sort of developer's own corporate account, and it must not go into any other sort of developer's project account. An idea of this is to protect investors' money, right? And this is why this podcast is called basically Buyer's Guide, to protect your money. And that's why, remember what I mentioned earlier, is the laws exist for what reason? Is to protect investors' money, to protect sort of the weaker party. And the weaker party here is investor. Why? Because the investor is the one who's spending the money, right? The investor is the one who is parting with the money. So as per this escrow law, the money and in the escrow account can only be drawn down as construction progresses. So let's say, by way of example, a buyer is asked to transfer payments into account in the developer's company name, and that the developer's own bank. That's a serious red flag and a breach, and it can expose developer to, as per this law and other laws that also come into play, to fines, to even sometimes criminal liability, and also removal of the developer from the developer's register. So the penalties are quite severe. And ultimately, any developer that accepts money into account that is not escrow, it's committing basically a breach of the law. It's a violation of the law, a specific law that prohibits that practice. So as an investor, before you transfer, confirm that the account is in the project's name, that this escrow account or a bank account into which you are transferring money, that is, it's in the project's name, and that it also matches the escrow account of your specific project, which you can find on the DLD website or DLD record. So that's another benefit. I remember I said the DLD website is quite comprehensive and it's quite sophisticated. So every project does lay out, first of all, whether it was approved, when it was approved, the name of the escrow account or the numbers of the escrow account, the completion date and the construction milestones and the name of the developer and so on and so forth. So whenever you're given details to transfer money, it's very easy to verify. You go on the land department's website and then you can cross-check whether the escrow account number is the same. Now, when I'm talking about transferring money, I don't mean just the big amount of money at some point in time. By law, any money that goes towards payment of the specific project has to go into the escrow account. So that includes the booking fee, or sort of it's called reservation fee, however it's called, but basically any money that goes towards that specific project or unit in that specific project has to go into the escrow account. So this is important because often you might be told otherwise. It's okay, you can just pay me money now and I will transfer it later, or we don't need to transfer the booking form because it's just a booking form. It's not really a sales and purchase agreement, so don't worry about it. Like, you don't somehow, that these escrow laws do not apply to transfers that happen at the outset, like the reservation fee or the booking fee. That is not the case. Basically, the escrow law and the escrow requirements apply to all payments from the beginning. So once again, so the lesson of this specific point or this specific law is that, you know, before you transfer as an investor or a buyer, confirm the account in the project's name and that it matches the land department's records. So that's that. And then third is, you know, how is your payment structured? So this is another one. And again, I keep going back to sort of my time here, and it's a little bit of a trip down the memory lane, which is kind of fun. But it's just like I almost saw this onion grow, right? And it's just more and more layers and more layers appeared. And it's sort of fun to continue to look back and revisit and see how it's now become this sort of a very solid foundation. But I remember how these layers were added. So, for example, in addition to having to register in disposition of real estate in the interim register with the land department and having all the developers registered in time or properly, and the projects registered, and then the escrow accounts also, those law introduced that in terms of payments that a developer may require an off-plan investor to pay, they have to correspond with the construction milestones. Now, why that is important and relevant, because I remember, now again, that just shows you how long I've been here, how old, maybe sort of my practice is. I will call it my practice, not me. I remember the time when some developers back in the old days were offering these special deals, and where they'd say, okay, you pay 90% now, and I'll give you a discount, right? And I'll give you like 50% discount. Well, and a lot of people did that. And I had those clients who basically paid, some people even paid 100%. Remember, we're talking about off-plan properties. So they paid 100% just so they can get 50% discount. But here you are paying so-called 50% discount, but you're paying 100% towards a project that doesn't exist yet. So it's just in the paper form. So if something goes wrong, and this was the era before escrow accounts, when I'm talking about something goes wrong, it did go wrong, because that's how things used to be before these laws came into effect, is that, you know, all of a sudden your people were left with nothing. They didn't have, they were out, 100% out from, of, you know, they paid all the entire amount and they had nothing except a piece of paper. And even that piece of paper was arguably, in many cases, not even registered with the land department. So basically, this is, again, since the laws are there to exist to protect investors and buyers' interests, so the government decided and the legislators decided to to help measure the risk, and that is by setting up linking all payments to construction milestones. So it's no longer allowed by law for developers to say, well, I'll take 100% of your investment, or I'll take 50% of your investment. But if you give me 50% of your investment now, I will give you such and such discount. So that is not allowed. So the law clearly, and this is by the law that came a little later, because remember I told you about the onion. So this specific law tying a payment to construction milestones, and not just as opposed to some arbitrary calendar dates, it was introduced in 2010. Remember, we started 2007, 2008, now this is 2010. And that was by virtue of implementing bylaws of law, the bylaw to the law 13 of 2008. And it was called the Executive Council Resolution number 6 of 2010. And in particular, Article 20, basically, that stated, in addition to every project having its own escrow account and all the money going to the escrow account, in addition to that, all payments, investors' payments towards that project have to correspond with specific construction milestones. And so the law kind of sets out what those milestones should be. So that's another requirement for a developer to ultimately be compliant, for upland projects to be compliant. So that's what they must follow if they want to be compliant. Now, so if developer refuses to link payments to construction milestones, that same Article 20 of that Executive Council Resolution gives the buyer the right to go to court and terminate the contract, right? Because ultimately the contract was the developer's violate a specific law. So let's say a payment plan states that 10% in month one, 10% in month three, and with no reference to construction stages, that's usually kind of a warning sign. And you could be funding basically, and the idea is that you could be funding a building that has not moved off the ground. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of temptation from both sides, from developers, obviously, to try to get as much money as possible, but also from investors, because sometimes, and these days in particular, it's a little, sometimes people who have money sometimes have challenges in figuring out how to bring that money, to pay with that money within this country, for example. Let's say crypto. There's a lot of crypto money that recently has kind of been circulating in the market. And sometimes investors prefer to just, okay, well, if there's an opportunity for me to invest now, I just want to invest as much money as possible because now the window's open, I can bring this money here. Or let's say for the time being, whatever country they're coming from, there's no tax. Okay, let me bring all this money now and put it in with this developer. So there's some temptation can actually exist on both sides. And for the developers, of course, the more money they have up front, the better it is because they're more liquid. So the temptation is there for both sides and for sort of logical reasons. That being said, it's important to know that specific practice is against the law, against the Dubai law, and to requiring all payments to be linked to construction milestones as set out in the law. And the law clearly sets out in what sort of increments the payments have to be made. So the law is there. It has not changed. I know we're talking about a law from 2010, and we're now in 2026, so it's 16 years back. But until that law is changed along with all the other laws, in legal terms, that's the legal framework. Those are the laws that still exist that govern, and therefore, if there's a violation of those laws, then investor or buyer has a legal grounds to request for the contract to be terminated because the developer breached the law. So for investors, before you sign, if any sort of agreement, be it booking form or SBA, check that each payment is tied to real construction stage. And I'd say even if you think I don't mind paying on a different schedule, I mean, just know that if you make that choice and the developer makes it available from a legal standpoint, the developer is not acting as per the law, and therefore you, by following sort of that practice, even if it's your voluntary, in a way you're subjecting yourself to something that ultimately can compromise your interests. And this is exactly why these laws exist. Remember, the law exists so to protect your interests. So if you choose to go around them, so it's a bit of a at your own risk. Okay, so next point is the paperwork. I mean, by paperwork, remember, we're talking about off-plan projects. So in most cases, for the longest time, we are talking about nothing but the paperwork because there is no specific unit yet that you can sort of touch and feel. And it's all just a number of documents. And the paperwork starts from the time you see an advertisement, for a specific project, and little pictures and videos and you know, social media posts and so on and so forth, to the time you sit down and you sign your booking form and maybe get your receipt of payment or your invoice, and to perhaps any other sort of correspondences that happen between kind of throughout, to the time you receive the sales and purchase agreement. So any one of these documents, depending on the circumstances, but they ultimately comprise the universe of your of the contractual matter, right? So the universe of the terms and conditions of your transaction, the underlying transaction. So it's not to say that because I have the sales and purchase agreement here and I have your two or three other documents that came before that, that only this document supersedes. That's not necessarily the case. That generally speaking, the courts will read the entire sort of universe of what they believe reasonably would comprise the terms and conditions of a party's agreement. Now, that specific point I'm talking about, that's less about the Dubai laws. That's the one that's subject to the civil transactions law, and that's on the definition of your, what is a contract, what constitutes a contract, and how do you interpret the contract. So all that is a kind of more substantive discussion about how do you interpret this universe of different pieces of paper to give it meaning. So that's subject to the transactions law, and this is where I'd say in many cases there could be some legal arguments that would give investors or your investors an opportunity to at least argue, or at least pay attention to make sure that there is no breach. And that's because you need to make sure that all the representations that kind of this that you were induced by, for example, this project is going to look like this and it's going to be completed on such and such date, and it's, you know, it's going, and your specific unit is going to have this kind of a view, for example, this can be that sort of a size. So you need to make sure that all of these representations ultimately match the reality and match the sort of the written documents, because what we often see is that a lot of investors get very excited about investing in Dubai. Fair enough, it's all understandable. It is an exciting place, and when you look around, you kind of want a piece of that pie. And so, in their kind of giddiness and excitement, they tend to rely or a little more heavily maybe on representations of developers, of representatives of developers or real estate agents on pictures, versus looking actually at finally what they sign in the final document, be it a booking form or a sales and purchase agreement. So they sort of assume that, well, somebody said that, you know, with this specific investment, you will have access to, for example, this water park. And they just assume that it's, yes, that's basically part of the contract. And they do not look at whether that specific term made it into the contract itself. Or, for example, they're being told that the project will be completed, let's say in 2030. But in fact, when the sales agreements, and on that basis, they sort of get excited and they make the commitment to invest. And then in the final document, it looks like it's going to be in 2032, for example. So, or that then looking into investing into a project, and this all, by the way, real examples that we've come across, is that somebody wants to buy this investment project and they're investing it to be able to rent it out for either Airbnb, short-term, or however. And then when the final agreement comes in, it basically says it's restricted. You cannot be rented out without, let's say, the management approval, or you can either live there or you have to basically hand it over to the hotel to rent it out for you on a short-term basis. So in other words, there is often there's a mismatch between what investors are being told, or they maybe what they want to believe, and ultimately what makes it into the agreement. So It's really the burden really in the way is on the investors to make sure that can check the key facts and they're consistent and that they match what you're being told and more importantly what you expect for this project to deliver. So for example, the completion date and the unit details, the size of the units, you know, it has a balcony or a view. And if something is very important to you, make sure that it makes it into the contract. And obviously the project status. And you can check a lot of those details against the deal's official records. And so that, by the way, is just kind of a slight digression. So in terms of the contract, you will be told, well, you cannot put that in. We cannot include, for example, this view is part of your contract. But if you, because this, we cannot change the contract. And you will often hear that. But the idea here, if you are buying the specific unit, on the representation, it will have a view. And you're being told that, well, we cannot include that in the specific contract, but trust us, well, that's on you because if you are putting so much reliance and your whole investment is based on having a view, the burden should be on you to make sure that specific detail is included. It doesn't necessarily need to be included in the contract, but you should have at least an addendum to the contract that clearly states so these material terms, which are important to you, that they comprise this or the part of your agreement, and that can be done, if not by virtue of amending the contract itself, by an addendum. That's easy enough as long as it's signed by the right people. Just as a general rule, so if the developer represents, you know, one completion date, but let's say you look at the Dubai Land Department's records and they show another completion date, you know, that's something, that's a problem as well because there you are basically being misled. And under the civil transactions law, that's a form of deception. It can be at least categorized as a form of deception. And so in telling you something untrue that leads you to agree, and that specific sort of deception argument can entitle you to annul the contract or sort of void the contract because the idea here is that you're relying on sort of specific material. So it has to be material, obviously. So you're relying on that particular project to be either your unit particular size or to have a particular view particular dimensions and then or specifications and then or a specific date. And then ultimately you're being presented with on paper with something else. So that is a form of deception. And that's, you know, that is, as per the civil transactions law, in particular Article 172, that's a form of deception that will give you the legal right to annul the contract. And so one specific example we've just recently had is, let's say, a brochure, a booking form says completion will be 2030, right? And then you go to land department and it says completion is 2031. So you're clearly being misled. Now, I mean, somebody might argue, well, it's just 1 year. It's not a big difference, but it is a big difference because every day counts. And this is with investors' money. 1 year of having their money held up, I mean, by many people's account is a big difference. You know, it can lead to significant losses. That's an example of misrepresentation off the bat. So if you do decide to continue on with a developer despite that information, that's just that's for you to kind of carry the burden. But just be aware that is if you are being told one thing and in the contract and something else, then that's a representation, and that's because these are kind of major differences or major factors that can influence your decision and could be legal grounds for you to cancel. So just to conclude that section, so if you before you commit, cross-check every material fact against the Dubai Land Department and not just the developer's marketing brochure. Okay, so next is we're still kind of keeping up with the paperwork, and that's just cross-checking what it is that you're signing, right? So we talked about in the contractual side of things, you have multiple documents. You have the marketing brochure, and then you have the booking form, and you have what's called the sales and purchase agreement or the SPA. These are, in legal terms, are called contracts of adhesion, which means you take it or leave it. You don't really have an opportunity to negotiate. It's drafted entirely by the developer, and in many cases, they're very much one-sided. So these are in legal terms and the definition of a contract of adhesion and how to interpret them and how to deal with them is addressed in the civil transactions law. And there's a whole section on that And so these are you could have given a special interpretation by the courts, and have more, the courts have more discretion in how they interpret them, knowing that they're contract of adhesion, meaning that you as an investor didn't have an opportunity to negotiate. And that's what we're talking about earlier. Remember, some developers will tell you, well, this is, you know, we cannot change a contract. And that may be true because that contract was registered with the land department. But if you, again, if you're buying something, investing particularly your unit because it's important for you, the developer can always create an addendum to that contract. It's like a one-pager signed with the relevant parties, you know, to give you that assurance. So, but however it may be, but a lot of the time these sales and purchase agreements being contracts of adhesion, you know, and somehow things have developed in such a way and continue to develop that sometimes they are very much one-sided. So for example, there are often clauses, and we see this still to this day, where the developer gives themselves the right to cancel or terminate for any reason, and you know, with no penalties. Just basically, I'll give you your money back, but yeah, I can. Terminate the contract at any point in time, but does not give you, the investor, the equivalent right. So that, by the way, is not kind of good news in legal terms, and that's because under the civil transactions law, that basically is unfair. You know, these are called unfair terms. Unfair terms in contract of adhesion, and therefore, as per the civil transactions law, whenever you have a contract of adhesion that has these kinds of unfair terms, such as one-sided terms that give one party all the rights and all the benefits, and the other party basically is just kind of a behest of the first party. That's obviously an unfair contract. So in such cases, the courts, by law, have a discretion to either vary the contract and make that specific provision reciprocal. So in other words, whenever it reads the developer has all the rights, then the court will read that same clause to give the same rights to the other side as well, so that to make it fair. Or they can give interpret that contract as strike out that entire provision altogether, and put the parties more or less on the same footing. Whatever it may be, the general rule, again, this is as per the civil transactions law, any kind of unfair terms, discrepancy, inconsistency in the contracts of adhesion are always interpreted in the interest of the weaker party. The weaker party here being the investor, because they're the only ones who are basically paying, and so they have a lot more at fault. So they're to lose. And because the contract of adhesion, meaning they didn't really have an opportunity to negotiate or sort of change the terms, that's why the overarching principle of contracts of adhesion is that the courts will always interpret those contracts in favor of the investor, in favor of the weaker party. And this, by the way, is addressed in specifics. There's specific articles in the law, and that's Article 120 and Article 223 that specifically... you make it very clear that any kind of such unfair terms are going to either be struck out or interpreted in favor of the investor. So generally speaking, the one-sided termination clause is not necessarily the last word, even if, you know, and that's what we have a lot of time clients come to us and say, well, that particular contract says it only gives the developer the right to terminate. Well, and they think that's sort of the end of it, but it isn't so. As per the law, you have equal protection and equal expectation. So to wrap up that particular point before you sign, you know, read every termination cancellation clause and ask, you know, why the rights are not reciprocal if that is the case. One more thing is in terms of the requirement for buyers to keep in mind is that, remember, here we registered the developers registered, the project was registered, there's an escrow account, now there is a construction payment plan, and you know, you have the sales and purchase agreement, so that's registered, and the booking forms that registered with the land department. Now, there's one more requirement, and that is that disposition of real estate, that sort of transfer of real estate interest, it has to be registered for off-plan properties. It has to be registered in the interim registry. Or register. And so that's called, in Arabic, it's called okud, sort of interim register. And that's the initial sale agreement. So this is not the title deed, because the title deed is issued for a property that's already ready and had been handed over. This is basically to register and protect that disposition of interest of off-plan property, where it's just, you know, a contract only. And by the way, that disposition of interest or OCUD registration has to be done immediately upon transfer of an interest. That means whenever the developer, whenever you sign a booking form or reservation form, that's already considered disposition of interest. And therefore, that specific transaction needs to be right away registered with the land department, you know, in OCUD as OCUD registration. And that, by the way, cost is a 4% of the purchase price, and that the investor has to pay to the land department to register that that sort of disposition of interest in the OCUD system. So this is very important, and this is exactly why it was introduced, so that the developer doesn't later on and go and either sell that same paper trail paperwork to someone else, or the or changes changes specifications on what that specific unit should be or the price should be and such. So that's why this OCUD system was developed. And and again, I've seen it progress over time. There was a time when it was only 2% of the purchase price, and then there was a time that you only had to pay 1,000 dirhams to register an OCUD and had to pay the remaining 2% only when the project was completed. Then they raised it to 4%, and now it's gotten to 4% upon the initial disposition of interest. So you have to basically pay the burden is on the developer. The developer needs to make sure that they collect the 4% from the investor whenever the booking form is signed, and that they register the booking form in OCUD system immediately. Not wait until, let's say, some other form is or some other document signed. And kind of on that end, this what we see still today is that these transactions start within the reservation form or like a booking form, and then months go by between that time and when the sales and purchase agreement is being handed over to the purchasers and say, okay, now you sign the sales and purchase agreement. So that is actually, in legal terms, not proper order of things unless this specific booking form is registered in OCUD immediately, one, and two, the terms of this booking form ultimately match the sales and purchase agreement. Because also what we've seen is that when the sales purchase agreement comes, the material terms actually differ from what was in the booking form. So that's what we talked about earlier. You know, if this, whenever the SPA comes in, just because your disposition of interest was already registered with OCUD and you pay, and the developer paid your 4% that you had given to the developer to pay to the land department, does not mean that now you're required to sign this SPA no matter what. Because if the SPA in material terms differs from what you were being told and from what sort of the evidence shows, for example, in terms of completion date, price, the sort of project specifications or what have you, then you have full right to rescind the whole transaction. That's because there's a mismatch in material terms. This is where we go back to the civil transactions law that clearly sets out that, you know, this could be structured or deemed as misrepresentation, for example, or unfair contract, and so on and so forth. So remember, you are not bound to sign that sales and purchase agreement when it comes to you if it, in material terms, it misrepresents the initial requirements or representations that you were given. Okay, so now let's kind of run through. I've sort of run through some of these as I was going through the specific legal arguments. I run to examples of what can go wrong, but we can run this just to wrap up the specific sort of, I guess, cases that we see quite regularly and that touch upon these different legal provisions. So, which ultimately amount to what's called a flawed transaction, and you know, each one of these has a familiar pattern from practice, and each is tied to a kind of a check we just covered. So let's say example number one, a buyer pays a reservation fee and then several installments after this, or over, you know, pays over 1 million dirhams across a few weeks. Well, only later he learns that the project was actually not registered with the land department yet or approved. So under law number 13 of 2008, that contract is considered null and void, and then therefore the buyer is entitled to a refund. Example two is the wrong account. So like a buyer, let's say, is asked to transfer payments into an account in the developer's company name and not the developer's kind of or the developer's own bank account, not into the escrow bank account. Once again, that's a direct breach of the escrow law, and it exposes the developer to all sorts of, you know, fines and potential criminal liability, and, you know, ultimately removed from the register. And so it gives you as a buyer a right to rescind the contract. So let's say example three is the counterpayment plan, right? A buyer signs a payment plan that's tied to a fixed monthly date of your payments, and there's no link to construction. So he pays 40% of the price while the building is still at 0% completion. So because the installments in this case are not tied to milestones, he has a statutory right to terminate and recover what he paid. Example four is like, let's say the moving completion date, you know, booking form, and we mentioned this, a booking form promises completion in 1 year. And the DLD's official record shows that completion, in fact, is in 2 years, so a full year apart. So that gap can be deemed as misrepresentation and therefore grounds to cancel. Example five is, you know, accrued, sort of lack of accrued registration, or if an interest was registered with accrued without the buyer's approval. So, for example, a buyer cancels in writing. So, as I said, I don't want to proceed with this transaction, and I refuse to sign the SPA and says, it has not yet been registered with OCUD. Then weeks later, the developer runs very fast the land department and registers in OCUD, knowing that the buyer has already basically canceled or expressed interest in canceling the transaction. And then the developer uses the buyer's money to register that project with an OCUD system. So basically using the buyer's money without their authorization because they've already expressed interest in canceling or exiting the transaction. So it's without the buyer's knowledge or consent, just to kind of keep up the pressure for the buyer to sign and pursue the transaction. So that's, you know, it's not so much of a contractual problem, but it's using, in this case, the developer is using person's funds against the instructions and that can go into, basically can cross into the breach of trust, which could be a criminal matter in the UAE. So each one of these has the same sort of root cause. The buyer paid before checking, and each one has a way out. So just some examples. Now, what can you do if you find yourself in this situation? Now, depending on which one of these sort of laws is at play and the circumstances. And by the way, these sort of remedies are set out in this civil transactions law and specifically. And there's at least, you know, kind of at a high level, three different routes. So number one is this, you can unwind the deal, right? So if you have a legal ground, so for example, the project was unregistered or the payment plan was unlawful or that you were misled, you can demand cancellation and your money back. So then where a contract is considered to be null and void, the law restores both parties to their pre-contractual position, and that's, you know, specifically addressed in Article 237 of the Civil Transactions Law. In practice, this usually starts with a formal legal notice, setting out the sort of the violations, the legal bases, and the clear demand for refund within a specific deadline. So, and generally speaking, a well-grounded legal notice does often resolve the matter on its own without having to escalate it to court. So that's route number one. Route number two is settlement. Obviously, that's always kind of the best way forward. And it's the smartest way forward if you can actually agree to a reasonable settlement. And, you know, settlement is faster, it's cheaper, and it's much more certain than the court. And here, this is where the law gives the buyer kind of real leverage. So a developer, for example, who sold before registration or took the funds into the wrong account is exposed to fines and criminal liability and potential removal from the register. So that exposure is a powerful incentive for the developer to either return your money or to resolve the matter amicably in whatever way, whatever settlement the developer may deem acceptable or palatable to them, you know, apart from returning the money to you. And they can do this quietly, sort of by way of settlement, so not to escalate matters further. So, you know, for example, faced with a clear breach and credible legal notice, many developers will just either refund the money or, you know, then litigate. And not all, but, you know, we've often seen a lot of developers who just hold their ground until they're taken into court. And then court, you know, remember, the courts are there to interpret and apply these laws that we're talking about. So the courts are not going to apply the same laws just because because a developer has one name or the other. That's the job of the court, is to apply the law. So they will, if these legal grounds, I've set them out today, if any of them are kind of breached and there's the remedy is applicable, that they will apply that specific remedy. So now the route number three is obviously court and regulators. So You can file a formal action, and that's usually the last resort. Now, your channels are, depends on the type of transaction. You can either file a complaint to RERA, or you file sort of a case with Dubai courts. And sometimes, depending if your funds are being misused, you can even get the Dubai police involved as well. Once the case is in the courts, the court, as part of the remedies set out in the civil transactions law, can either declare the contract void altogether, you know, and restore the parties to their original position, i.e. the investor gets the full refund, or they can order the refund directly, or they can award costs or some sort of compensation. But obviously the court takes money and it takes time and there's always, and much still depends on the evidence that's being presented, the documents and the kind of the legal argument, the strategy that's being put forward. So there's a little bit of obviously risk potentially if it's not argued or litigated correctly. So if there is an opportunity to settle instead of litigate, that's always advisable, and hopefully more developers will see that and actually find business reasons to instead of taking this and testing the buyers and investors appetite or resolve to go to court, but instead sit around the table and kind of figure out some sort of amicable settlement, out of court settlement. But that's why I almost always tried sort of rescission and settlement first, and then to keep the court as a backstop. If everything else fails, obviously you have the court. So now let's see, talk about the practical checklist before you sign off, just to kind of wrap it all up. So if you are an investor, if you are new in Dubai, or if you're new to off-plan property, or you want to do things differently this time around, if you just want to have like a quick checklist. So number one, to confirm the project is registered and the developer and purchaser are both registered and approved with the land department. Next, you confirm that you're paying to the project escrow account, dedicated account, in the project's name, and never in the developer's, just corporate bank account. Confirm that your installments are tied to construction milestones. Cross-check the completion and the unit details against the DLD's own records, which are publicly available. Read the booking form and the sales and purchase agreement, SPA, especially the termination and cancellation clauses. Make sure that things that don't make sense to you know, that you're aware of them and negotiate them accordingly. And then ultimately, in practical terms, keep every receipt, keep all the payment records, messages, and document everything. Don't rely on just oral representations. So often we hear clients that come and say, well, but we were told so-and-so, we were represented by so-and-so. And when you try to go down to, okay, so what exists to show those representations, these are like Telegram messages, WhatsApp messages from some random phone numbers that not necessarily linked to the developer. So make sure that if there's any material representation that you are relying on that comprise your decision base, that at least you have documents, your written documents to prove that those were put forward and whoever put forward them actually had the legal capacity to represent the developer on that front. So in conclusion, kind of let me summarize quickly. So buying property in Dubai is safe. It's safer than it ever been. But you need to know the rules, and you need to buy the right way. So the project must be registered before you pay. Your money belongs to a project escrow account. Your payment should follow construction milestones, not some sort of calendar dates. Your paperwork should match the official record as per the DLD website and record. And generally speaking, unfair contracts can be corrected by the court. And if something has already gone wrong, remember there's the three routes: there's rescission, there's settlement, and finally there's the court. So the moral of the story is that the law gives buyers real protection in this market, but protection only works if you check before you pay and not after. So verify the project, verify the account, verify the paperwork, and if something does not add up, pause, get advice before you transfer a single dirham. That's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website, that is lylawyers.com. We're also an Apple podcast and Spotify, and for the full experience, you can watch our video podcast on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.